I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Stuart Turton, on his latest novel, The Last Murder at the End of the World.
Stuart Turton's debut novel, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, won the Costa First Novel Award and the Books of My Bag Readers Award for Best Novel, and was shortlisted for the Specsavers National Book Awards and the British Book Awards Debut of the Year. A Sunday Times bestseller, it has been translated into over 30 languages and has sold over a million copies in the UK and US combined. The Devil in Dark Water, his follow-up, won the Books of My Bag Readers Award for Fiction and was selected for the BBC Two Book Club Between the Covers and the Radio 2 Joe Wiley Book Club. And today we're here to talk about Stuart's latest novel, which is The Last Murder at the End of the World. Stu, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us, first of all, then, how you would describe this novel.
This one, so far, I've written a locked room murder mystery. That was my first book. And then a locked boat murder mystery. That was my second one. And this is my locked island murder mystery. So this is set 90 years after the world ended. Everybody died. They were wiped out by this black fog that covered the planet. The survivors are gathered on this one small Greek island. There's only 122 people left, and there's barriers up to keep the fog out. And then life for the last 90 years has been completely perfect. There's been no murder. There's been no violence. There's no arguments. Everybody's genuinely really happy, lovely, selfless, kind. It's perfect. And then one of these people turns up dead and they've been murdered. So the villagers have got to figure out what murder actually is, why it happens and why it's happened now.
I spotted an allusion to at least to Devil in Dark Water. So I just wondered if you see these books as all sort of like inhabiting the same universe, as it were.
Yeah, I like doing that. I think it's really interesting for readers who've read previous books. I think people get like a little thrill out of seeing things that they recognize and sort of connections they can make between books. So I like throwing those Easter eggs in just because of that, just because I think it rewards people who've read the books previously. I don't really need to do anything else with it. It doesn't need to say anything broader than, hey, look, those books exist in this world. Thanks for reading them.
So the novel is narrated by something called Abby, who is not a person, but is, I guess, a sort of AI. I'm always going to want to say she because her name is Abby, because their name is Abby. Its name is Abby. A sort of security system, and it inhabits the minds and can sort of gently direct, shall we say, without trying to give too much away, the actions of the other characters. So let's talk about this narrator and I guess what this narrator also says on a sort of like wider level about the idea of a narrator and storytelling in and of itself.
I think that's really interesting, the idea of what it broadly says. I'm fascinated by meta commentaries in books. I always do it. So like in Seven Deaths, my first novel, that was all about the chronology of a book and sort of like how books are structured, and that book ripped up time and messed around with it. But it really was like a meta commentary on sort of how murder mysteries are built, which is that the investigator goes, investigates a lot of people. They tell you what happened on that day to the best of their recollection. Then we move on to the next person. And the investigator slowly unpicks that and works out what are lies and what's a fact. And Seven Deaths didn't do anything more except you lived those witness accounts firsthand. That's what that novel was doing. It just changed the person of those accounts. And it sounded completely new. Devil had this mechanic where the two main characters, Aaron and Sammy, were like a Sherlock Holmes Watson dynamic duo. But they were constantly referring to cases they'd solved in the past, almost the way Sherlock Holmes does with his case books, except I'd never written those books and the reader had never experienced them. But they existed within this world. And again, that was a very meta commentary on the way those books were structured. So this, for something like Abby, it's just the omniscient narrator, except she is an omniscient narrator. She's in everybody's thoughts. She can hear everything everyone's thinking. She knows what they're feeling as well in a deeper sense. She's just playing the author in the story. And just like the author, she has her own secret. She has her own things that she's not willing to divulge to the reader as the story goes along. She's holding things back for her own reasons. So it's weird. It's like it's the closest to a writer character that I'll ever put in a book, I think. Like it's the closest thing to me actually being in the novel, sort of guiding readers through it, saying you can have this, but you can't have this yet. You'll learn about that later. Hold your horses.
And you mentioned that the meta narrative of all of these books. And I can remember particularly when we talked about The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, you're talking about how you created the book, how you structured it, and how that one was all done with a spreadsheet with all the characters and all the times and everything plotted out on it. And then when we talked about The Devil of the Dark Water, there was a different method. And you chose a different method. So what have you done here?
This one I storyboarded out. So for people who aren't aware of that, and how dare you not listen to these interviews previously? God, what have you been doing with yourselves? But I always have a different planning technique for each book that I write because it makes the book feel new and fresh to me. It sort of convinces my brain that I'm embarking on some new activity, not just sitting down at a computer for 8 hours a day for the next 2 years, which is what I'm actually doing. So for Seven Deaths, a huge Excel spreadsheet, as you said. For Devil, it was a kind of a huge map almost with like big moments that I had to hit, but I let myself get there freely. And that was almost drawn out so it looked like a map with little islands on it. For this one, I actually storyboarded it out. So it was almost like a movie. I drew pictures of the big scenes and just like did that for every sort of almost every chapter, every couple of chapters. Every time something huge would happen, I would have a little visual moment, almost like I was pointing the camera at it. And I want to point out that I can't draw. I'm a terrible drawer. So I'm a terrible artist. So these were just little stick figures and little like terrible crude drawings of a lighthouse and flowers and other things that go on. But there was about 6 pages of it. Little illustrations just connected by arrows, just showing how the novel visually would flow and where the big beats would be and what interesting things I would focus on in the writing, if that makes sense. So it was almost kind of directing my head camera at things. It was a really, genuinely really, really lovely way to plot. I enjoyed it.
So you alluded to the disaster that's befallen the world earlier, and we'll come back to that in a second. But before that, tell us something about the world you envision that's sort of hinted at in this book, or, you know, people remember it. Some of the characters are able to remember what happened in the past. What was the world like before this disaster?
It was just this world. It was just this world on its current sort of trajectory. So too few resources for too many people, epic squabbles, wars going on in every corner, and then the 1% or the top 5% getting richer and richer and richer while everybody else got poorer and poorer and poorer. I think there was an idea as well that maybe didn't make it into the novel that what we class as luxury goods had started to sort of spread to things like fresh fruit and vegetables and things like that. They'd become luxury goods. Everybody else was getting super processed vitamin packs and things like that. So the divide between wealth and not wealth had gone further than you can buy a nicer car than other people and come into the realm of like, actually you can live a healthier life because you get proper food. So it was those sorts of divisions that started to spring up. And I think, and out through that, the human race saw these ecological disasters befalling them, but weren't doing anything to solve them or weren't moving fast enough to solve them, but they were developing super weapons and biological weapons to wipe each other out with.
The mix of when the villagers, who are the sort, you know, the majority of people living on the island in the story, who we'll get to later, but they are surrounded by, first of all, lots of ruins and buildings that they don't know what they are, but like maybe we can piece together what some of these things might have been. But then later in the book, they also happen to come across through ways we won't actually talk about, like more science fiction technology, for want of a sort of better word, and more things in labs, which they're describing them, but it's stuff that like we can't ourselves tell what this is because it's, you know, this is, like you say, it's our world, but it's clearly a future world.
Yeah, I think the entire idea behind it was that I wanted to, when you're mixing genres, and I'm always mixing genres in my novels, I found out very early on Seven Deaths that you need to pick a core genre and then you can build around it. So you don't get to have equal parts of everything. You don't get to have a crime science fiction novel that's 50% crime, 50% science fiction. It just doesn't work. So what I always do is I go 75% crime, and then the remainder is science fiction and what other little genres I want to put in. So for this, I wanted to envisage a sci-fi novel that had all the sort of like the trappings of a sci-fi novel without getting into it too much. So there's always like future technologies, but you can just about work out what they might have been or what they would be, other extrapolations of things that we currently have. And to the villagers who've lived 90 years without any of this stuff, it all seems like magic. But for us, it's quite near future. And I like the idea of having this sort of utopian dystopia, this idea that they've almost technologically gone backwards, but they're as happy as they've ever been. And though they can see all this stuff and they can see the value of it, it's not crucial to the way they're living their lives. There was something really appealing about writing that kind of society rather than, for example, a science fiction book where everyone would just be living in that society. That, for whatever reason, that just didn't appeal to me at all. I didn't want to write a book in the future.
And the fog that has overtaken the world and has killed everybody, what is this?
Oh, that's for the novel. The fog is a mechanical device. It is a way of trapping everybody on this island so the murder mystery can happen. Because if you're writing a murder mystery and you've got a large cast of characters, like I always have, you've got to stop them leaving the story. And you've got to give an organic reason why they can't go and just come and go, and why new people aren't coming in, and why people can't go and get help or whatever it is. I've always done that in different ways. In Seven Deaths, you had an isolated house. In Devil, you had a boat that was out at sea, could never go anywhere, no, couldn't get to civilization. So for this one, it's an island. It's just an island surrounded by a fog, and everything in the fog is dead. Like, the fog killed everybody. And sort of the book talks about where that fog came from, why it's there, but it really does. It's the background threat. It's the thing that they're racing against time to defeat and to understand. And I like those sorts of plot devices in my novels. The Seven Deaths had a footman that did a sort of similar role in the story. It was there to keep everybody on their toes. It was there to keep the tension high. So that's always what's happening underneath it. There's this fog. It's a brilliant thing to write for me creatively. Like, it's a wonderful thing to keep describing and keep coming back to. But it's serving a mechanical purpose in the novel and in the plotting.
And the island itself, describe it for us and tell us something about your process of creating this island.
The island is supposed to be like, it's a small Greek island, but it's a sort of composite of a lot of Greek islands. So it doesn't actually exist. You can't really go there. But it has the terrain of one of the scraggier, shrubbier Greek islands. So it's not one of the paradises. It's very volcanic rock, lots of like brown earth, lots of small, scraggy, dusty plants. It's that kind of place. And I wanted it to feel like the villagers, even though they're super happy and even though they are selfless and kind, that's all about them. It's not because they have all this stuff around them. It's not because they live on an island paradise. It's not because, you know, they're bathing in wine and eating grapes all day. Their lives are hard and they lose their lives all the time. They fall prey to sickness and death and other things that happen on the island. So their happiness is entirely about them creating it, because the situation is not perfect, it's not ideal. And again, I wanted to make the island feel like this almost hostile place, this place that's difficult for them to explore and it's difficult for them to get around, because they actually all live in this small village, which is an old naval base, and they have high walls. They don't often go outside of it. They're really not allowed to go outside of it, and they don't want to because there's not really much out there. It's the perfect scene for secrets. It's the perfect island to have things buried away for them to uncover and go out into this hostile terrain and have to sort of defeat things to find out what they need.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Stuart Turton, and we're talking about his latest novel, The Last Murder at the End of the World. And Stu, let's spend some time talking about some of the characters in the book there. We've already mentioned Abby, who is the narrator, who oversees this whole island. But just beneath or parallel to Abby, there are three scientists and then all of the villagers. So we want to talk about the three scientists first of all. So Nima, who is the chief scientist, tell us something about who she is.
Nima, when you first meet her, and she's my favourite kind of character, she's a character who presents as one thing on the first page and who, after a paragraph and after a chapter, the reader will think they know. They'll think they've seen her before. They'll think they understand who this character is. And then the more you learn about her, the more she shifts, but hopefully not in a direction that you expect. She had an entire life before the fog, before the apocalypse, before the world ended. She lived in the old world. She was very much a part of it. She was at the forefront of it. And she's come to realize that with all that stuff gone and all that stuff that fell away, what she valued and what she prized didn't have as much worth as she thought it did. And she's really found something on the island amongst these people. But she's incredibly flawed. She's made mistakes. And the villagers idolize her at the beginning of the novel, and as they go along and they begin to work out more about who she is and what she actually stood for, that changes. But I still hope, and my idea always is to give characters shades so that she could do bad things and she could make mistakes, but you can still feel incredible sympathy for her. You can still understand why she did the things she did. And that's always the key, I think. Like, I don't ever really like writing villains. I don't want to write someone who's just bad, because I don't think many of them truly exist in the world. I want to write these characters who have terrible choices to make and sometimes make the wrong ones.
And then another scientist is her son, Hephaestus. Tell us something about him.
Oh, he was great fun to write. It took me a long time to work him out. He's this hulking brute of a guy. I wrote a hulking brute in Devil in the Dark Water, a guy called Aaron Hayes, but he was all strength and nobility and purpose. Hephaestus he was effectively a playboy in the old world. He had all the money in the world. He just crashed sports cars and slept around. And in the new world, he's trying to survive, but he's got all this size and he's got all this strength, but he's never used it. He doesn't know what it's for. So he's just an intimidating bully. That's all he's ever been. And now that the new world has happened, his way of adapting to it is kind of almost to sort of like be broken by it and embrace it and become the very worst of it. But again, the shades within that, he has nobility and he has streaks of purpose. He believes what he believes very, very strongly, and he will chase it to the ends of the earth. And the people he loves very, very deeply. So just like Neiman, and just like the character I suspect you're about to talk about, there should always be this idea that for one person, you seem to be this very 100% this specific thing, maybe a bad guy, maybe a good guy. But for the next person, you're something else entirely. We're always shifting depending on who we're dealing with.
Will indeed Thea, who is the third scientist, tell us why she is on the island?
So Thea was working with Hephaestus and Nema. So these three scientists were researchers, and they were on this island when it all went down. Hephaestus wasn't, but that's a longer story, and that's in the book. But they were on the island when everything started to go to hell, and they stayed on the island where it was safe, and they got other people onto the island. And Thea didn't expect to be on the island as long as she's been on the island. She is a relatively young woman. She looks young anyway. She's much younger than Neem, and it's beginning to wear on her life on the island. Like, she is the character who most misses the old world. So Neem has adapted. Hephaestus has sort of adapted, but Thea never will. Thea desperately wants the old world back. She wants her old equipment back. She wants her old life back. She wants to be able to drink a coffee in the morning, go to the cinema in the evening, and she can't do any of that. And she can't take any joy in the simple pleasures of the village. So she's yearning to get away, and she'll do anything to make that happen. And because of that, she kind of sees everyone as disposable. She sees everything as frivolous. She's very single-minded in the pursuit of what she thinks is the correct cause for humanity's future.
So these three scientists oversee 122 villagers, only a number of which are actually named in the story. And indeed, the plot mainly revolves around one extended family of villagers, who we'll talk about some of them in a moment. But just give us a bit more insight into you've already mentioned this a little, but tell us a little bit more about the day-to-day life of these villagers.
So the villagers are basically primarily about keeping themselves alive. So they're vegans, the lot of them. So they have animals, but they roam wildly. They farm to keep themselves alive. They fix the village to keep that in good repair. And they have this voice in their head, Abby, which is constantly, as you said earlier, sort of nudging them towards being better, to be kinder, to be more selfless. But that job's almost done now after 90 years. So they're very, very lovely people. And then in the evenings, they practice hobbies. So they'll do woodworking or pottery, or they'll practice music. And they have very simple lives, very simple goals. And they're all happy with that. But they have these strict rules. They're not allowed to leave the village without one of the scientists, the elders, as they're referred to in the book. They have this curfew. So I can't remember exactly what time it is, but I think it's about 7:30 or something. They just fall asleep, whatever they are. So the curfew is imposed and they just fall asleep. So they all need to be tucked up in their beds, otherwise they're sleeping on the floor outside. And they always awake at exactly the same time in the morning. So there's lots of odd things in the world governing them. And only one of the villagers, which is our primary character, Emery, is bothered by any of this. They've all been trained out of asking questions about it. They've all been shamed into not asking questions about it because everything's so wonderful. Why would you? But Emery has questions and Emery's curious, and that's sort of made her a pariah in the village.
Yeah, so Emery is the character I want to come on to next, she's the protagonist of the novel. She has as I mentioned, a lot of the characters are part of Emery's, a lot of the major characters in the story are part of Emery's extended family. She has a rather fractious relationship with her father and her daughter. Tell us something about that.
It's a funny thing. So if you take a standard murder mystery novel, what you immediately discover when you break it down and you sort of look at how it functions, which is what I'm always doing, is that the way it works is the cast of characters are all shady, even the ones who aren't. Like, they all have secrets, and it's the job of the investigator to uncover those secrets and work out whether those secrets were worth murdering somebody for. And you know, 9 times out of 10, they're not. Those people are dismissed, but you still got to dig through the secrets. But because this island is filled with genuinely beautiful, lovely, selfless, kind people, that was really hard because they don't have that darkness inside of them. And to put that darkness inside of them would have sort of portrayed the core conceit of the novel. So what I ended up with was trying to plot a novel where nobody had a reason to commit a murder, and they generally don't have a reason to commit a murder. And even once I got that sorted and worked out how that could occur and why that would occur and what would be a logical extension for that, I still had the problem of trying to write a novel. Novels thrive on conflict. They thrive on drama. They thrive on incident. And again, it's very hard to generate that with people who are just nice and kind to each other all the time. And it occurred to me that even in this society, the sort of the one area, the one part of our lives that will always have conflict will be family. Just families manufacture it amongst themselves. There's something about hope and disappointment and expectation that we have of each other, that we have of our children and our parents have of us, that's always ripe for exploration. I don't think that will ever change, no matter what the society becomes. So that's why we ended up with this core cast of kind of an extended family. This, as you said, the father who's disappointed in his daughter, the daughter who doesn't understand her daughter. And then these people who are just circling each other and trying to work with each other and trying to understand each other. They love each other to bits, but they just cannot get on. And the novel becomes, it boils down to this family just discovering each other and sort of working out what's special about each other now that everything's gone to hell.
How does Emery end up being the investigator? There is a murder in this village. It's a murder mystery novel. And she is thrust into the position where she ends up being the sort of chief investigator. Why her?
Because in a village where nobody asks questions, the person who asks one question is the king. And I think in this situation, Emery's gone through her entire life not knowing what her purpose was. Everybody in the village has a purpose. They have a role. They fix things, or they mend boats, or they mend nets, or they fix roofs. Everybody has a job, and she doesn't. Her core skill set is of no use in this world. She's great at asking questions. She's great at observing people. As she reads murder mysteries, she's the only person on the island who's allowed to read murder mystery novels from the old world. And she has this fascination with it. She has this fascination with murder and with crime. Even though she can't truly understand it, she's fascinated by the mechanics of it. And as I said earlier, that made her a bit of a pariah. But when there is a murder, there's kind of only one person who can help you out. And it's Emery. And she sort of fumbles a bit and she struggles with it a little bit because she doesn't understand the emotions underpinning what's happening. So it's really about her learning human emotions, like emotions from the old world when we could be brutal to each other, when we could be unkind, when we could hurt each other for no other reason than we were in pain. So, I mean, that was just really a really fascinating thing to write a novel that's kind of exploring murder as it's solving a murder. That was a lot of fun.
Well, part of that, of course, as well, is there's another plot device in the book, which is, it's not giving anything away because it's mentioned in the blurb of the book. You mentioned, obviously, that they're all on this island surrounded by this fog. So the fog is the thing that's like keeping them in the closed room, as it were. Obviously, this is all the vast majority of these people are, you know, nice and kind and harmless. So why would they commit a murder? And then there is this device where all of their minds are white. So even the murderer does not know that they have done it. So tell us something about when you came up with this device.
I remember when I came up with that idea, I simultaneously smiled and shat myself. Like it was this immediate weird reaction because I knew it was going to be really good fun to write. And I should preface this by saying that most of what I do is about trying to entertain myself because I know when I set out to write a new novel, it's going to take me a long time. I'm a slow writer. It's going to take me 2 years of solid writing and I work 8 hours a day. This is my full-time job. So I'm going to be sitting at a computer writing these novels. And it's not the most natural thing for me. I really like being outside. I really like climbing things or running or swimming or being out with my kids. So if I'm going to sit down in front of a computer and do this job, I need to be entertained and I need to be writing something that interests me that day. So when I came up with this idea that Abby, because she's in their heads, could obviously just remove their memories at will and had done so as a sort of security precaution, that was brilliant. Like, how do you solve a murder? How do you investigate a murder where even the murderer doesn't know they're the murderer, where nobody can remember what happened, so there's no witnesses to it? Just the plotting challenge of that seemed like too good to turn down. So I started plotting her out, and it genuinely was incredibly hard to do, and it was incredibly hard to make work and to make it so that the book constantly had instant and drive. But the more I started to get on top of the story and the more I started to work out why Emery was the perfect character to do this, the more the novel sort of, I don't know, just formed in front of me. It was like seeing something coming out of a mist and suddenly it was just right there. I think almost every day I was writing this novel, I was having fun. I was cackling. I mean, often I was desperately, desperately stressed trying to make it all fit together, but it was a lot of fun.
So to finish this off, then, can I get you to read us a bit?
No, yeah, of course. So what I'm going to read from is the prologue to the novel, which I've never written a prologue for a book before, but it fits what I was trying to do with this one. And it was actually one of the last things that I ever wrote because I realized quite late in the day that the novel needed a prologue, which again is a really interesting thing in the writing process when you realize it's almost there, but it's missing something. It just needs this one extra thing. And this is the one extra thing it needed. Is there no other way? Asks a horrified Nima Mandropilius, speaking out loud in an empty room. She has olive skin and a smudge of ink on a small nose. Her grey hair is shoulder length and her eyes are strikingly blue, with flecks of green. She looks to be around 50 and has done for the last 40 years. She's hunched over a desk lit by a solitary candle. There's a pen in her trembling hand and a confession beneath it that she's been trying to finish for the last hour. None that I can see, I reply in her thoughts. Somebody has to die for this plan to work. Suddenly short of her, Nima scrapes her chair back and darts across the room, swiping aside the tattered sheet that serves as a makeshift door before stepping into the muggy night air. It's pitch black outside, the moon mobbed by storm clouds. Rain is pummeling the shrouded village, filling her nostrils with the scent of wet earth and cypress trees. She can just about see the tops of the encircling walls, etched in silver moonlight. Somewhere in the darkness, she can hear the distant squeal of machinery and the synchronized drumbeat of footsteps. She stands there, letting the warm rain soak her hair and dress. I knew there'd be a cost, she says, her voice numb. I didn't realize it would be so high. There's still time to put this plan aside, I say. Leave your secrets buried and let everybody go about their lives as they've always done. Nobody has to die. And nothing will change, she shoots back angrily. I've spent 90 years trying to rid humanity of its selfishness, greed, and its impulse towards violence. Finally, I have a way to do it. She touches the tarnished cross hanging around her neck for comfort. If this plan works, we'll create a world without suffering. For the first time in our history, there'll be perfect equality. I can't turn my back on that because I don't have the strength to do what's necessary. Nima speaks as if her dreams were fish swimming willingly into a net. But these are murky waters, far more dangerous than she can see. From my vantage in her mind, and the minds of everybody on the island, I can predict the future with a high degree of accuracy. It's a confluence of probability and psychology, which is easy to chart when you have access to everybody's thoughts. Streaking away from this moment are dozens of possible futures, each waiting to be conjured into existence by a random event, an idle phrase, a miscommunication, or an overheard conversation. Unless a violin performance goes flawlessly, a knife will be rammed into Nima's stomach. If the wrong person steps through a long closed door, a huge scarred man will be emptied of every memory, and a young woman, who isn't young at all, will run willingly to her own death. If these things don't happen, the last island on Earth will end up covered in fog, everything dead in the gloom. We can avoid those pitfalls if we're cautious, says Nima, watching lightning tear through the sky. You don't have time to be cautious, I insist. Once you've committed to this plan, secrets will surface, old grudges will come to light, and people you love will realize the extent of your betrayal. If any of these things disrupt your plan, the human race will be rendered extinct in 107 hours. Nima's heart jolts, her pulse quickening. Her thoughts waver, only to harden again as her arrogance takes the reins. The greatest achievements have always brought the greatest risk, she says stubbornly, watching a line of figures walking stiffly in the darkness. Start your countdown, Abby. In 4 days, we're either going to change the world or die trying.
So I've been talking to Stuart Turton. We've been talking about his latest novel, The Last Murder at the End of the World, which is out now in the UK from Raven Books. Stu, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thanks for having me, mate. I really appreciate it.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.